upon his flesh. Then he said, God, do so, and more also to me, if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, shall stand on him this day. But Elisha sat in his house, and the elders sat with him, and the king sent a man from before him. But ere the messenger came to him and said to the elders, see how see ye how this son of a murderer hath sent it to take away my head. Look, when the messenger cometh, shut the door, and hold him fast at the door. Is not the sound of the master's feet behind him? And while he yet talked with them, behold, the messenger came down unto him and said, behold, this evil is of the Lord. What should I wait for the Lord any longer? Why should I wait for the Lord any longer? How in the world do you just... A novice Christian should not read passages like this. Because how do you make sense out of all this? But I want you, we want to look at this in a way that I trust brings it into some kind of perspective. Because when the king, obviously a bad king, was there and he was making decisions, the first thing we find out in verse 24 is that when the Old Testament city, basically they came and the king of Syria gathered his host and they went up and besieged Samaria. What that word besieged means is all they would do is they would sit there and they would surround the city and just wait. They didn't have any fights. They didn't have any battles. They starved them out. They shut off all the access of their food. They shut off all the access of their help. That was interesting. If you go to the Horseshoe Curve, anybody been to Horseshoe Curve in Altoona? And you read about that, they actually caught, during World War II, they caught a submarine load of men going there to blow that railroad up because it was a central line of supplies to go to the port to go into World War II. And so it's not a new thing. It's something that a lot of the military, they cut off the supplies. So when we see in verse 24 that this king went and besieged Samaria, all they did was they surrounded it. And as they surrounded it and they waited them out, they had all the food they needed. They had all the supplies because anything coming into the city they took anyway. So all they had to do was wait. Sooner or later they would give in and give up. So that is what the scenario is. And verse 25 says, and there was a great famine in Samaria. Why was there a great famine in Samaria? Because of the siege. It worked. It worked. And so when we see this siege, basically the famine, how do we know how severe this famine was? Well, the first sign is that the head of a donkey was sold for 40 pieces of silver to eat. Wasn't to mount on a wall. It was to eat. So as we see this, the next phrase was, it gets better. After you buy the donkey's head to eat, then you can buy the four-part of cab of a dove's dung to eat. Anybody signing up for that? And what they were doing is they were literally selling the dove dung, which dung is poo, to eat. How desperate would you have to be? A friend of mine in Alaska, some of you may, I don't know if you ever watched that show Alone, Roland, Rockhouse Roland. He won the $1 million prize, but he's the guy that we went to Alaska with, and Kevin and I. And he told me that he spends 3 months of complete solitude checking his trap lines every winter in Alaska. I mean, he's out there in a boon. He doesn't see, talk to, hear a soul for at least 3 months and then some. And he says, I know that I'm in trouble when I'm down to my last beaver tail. I would have been in trouble long before then, long before the last beaver tail. But this is where the famine, this is where that took them. Okay, they were eating the brains of the donkey. They were eating the dung of the birds. And then, when that was all gone, what did they go to next? Cannibalism. They were eating their own children. How do we ask God why he allows things in our world today? Wow. How could God sit back and let that happen? But again, was the king good or bad? He was a very bad king. And so when we see this next thing, and this is the scenario that is really interesting, because going for and understanding how bad this famine was. See, sometimes, you know, we realize that, you know, we have a drought in the Midwest, or we have a drought, and, you know, even in our own gardens, if we don't water them well, they don't produce much fruit. And we complain. I complain when you work hard and plant the garden and then there's nothing to show for it. But this is a famine like you and I would never want to be in. They literally were starving to death, literally eating anything digestible and paying top dollar for it. And then it went to their children. So this woman in verse 26 has a problem. As the king was out again passing by upon the wall, a woman cried to him, saying, "Help." And notice the word "Lord" is not capital. So she wasn't looking to God. She was looking at the ruler, the king, the Lord, and asking for help, "O king." And he said, again, first statement from the ruler and the king was this: if the Lord, capital L, do not help thee, what do you expect me to do? What do you want me to do? What mindset this king has? If God, you cry out to God, if he's not going to help you, what do you expect me to do? And he's walking this top of the wall, he's walking upon the wall again, passing by, probably trying to make sense, probably trying to see what he can do, trying to survive everything and everybody. But we have this lady now crying out because she had a problem. And basically, as we realize crying out for help, his mindset says, if God hasn't helped you yet, there's nothing I can do. And he finishes that with, shall I help thee out of the barn floor or out of the wine press? And the king said to her, what is your problem? What aileth you? What is the matter? If God is not going to get you out of this, what do you expect me to do? So basically, what has he done? He was the bad king. He was the one that, if disobeying God, which he did, put them in this predicament, he's now taking the blame and putting it where? On God. How many of us do that through life? How many of us look at God and blame God for the things that we may have initiated? There's a lot of people that live their life and they make statements and they'll say things to God or say things against God, and it literally puts them in a position that, you know, God, they're going to have some consequences to that. And I tell people all the time, you choose whatever you want. God has given you the freedom to choose. But don't come back to me and complain about his consequence, because he chooses that. If you're going to make this choice and you know it's not what you want, you know it's not right, you know it's not correct, then don't complain about the consequence, because your only option is in the choice. So this king is obviously not doing it right. And so the army is surrounding them now, and as the army surrounds them, we also find that the king is beginning to blame God. And that's one of the key principles we need to pull out of this, that we also at times blame God for our problems. God doesn't give us problems. He allows us to go through them. But God is not the author of confusion. And isn't it confusing to you that a loving God would allow you to go through something that looks like he is a terrible God? Is that not confusing? When you know who God is, but yet you're going through things and you blame God for things, and all of a sudden something's not right, because either my God is or my God isn't. And we know that God is. God always will be. He's a loving God, faithful God, just God, all of the attributes. And so life at times gets us to a predicament where we begin to blame God. When we blame God, confusion comes because it doesn't make sense in what we know of Him and what we experience in Him. So this, no doubt, begins to get even a little bit more, I think, crazy, because what she came to Him, when He asked her that question in verse 28, and she answered, "This woman said to me, 'Give thy son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow.'" I can't fathom that. I can't fathom that. Years and years ago, there was a plane wreck up in the Appalachian with one of the athletic teams, the Olympic athletic teams. And basically, that's how some of them survived, by eating the ones who have died in the crash. And man, they were just looked upon as the most ruthless people in the world. But what would you do? What would you do to survive? If you were going to die, what would you do? I mean, that's some tough choices, isn't it? We can always come, and what I'm saying that for is because we come to life and we know what choices we would want to make. But until you're there, you really don't know what choice you will make, because there have been many things that men have done on a starving belly that they never would have done if they had the food. And so looking at this, you may look at these women and think, man, how ruthless. It's not the problem that they ate the son. It's the problem that she reneged on her deal. And I find that very hard to understand. It wasn't the issue that the sons were dying and they were being eaten. It's a fact that they all ate well on her son. And when it was the other mom's turn, she said, "No, I ain't killing my son." And that was the problem. And so the king had to face this problem. But God is the one who protects us and blesses us when we don't deserve it. And so this king is trying to tell her, listen, if God's not going to help you, what can I do? There's nothing I can do, nothing I can share, nothing I can be a part of. And so now she brings him his problem. And again, verse 29 says that they did that. They boiled her son, they'd eat him, and they said unto her on the next day, "Give us your son." And she said, "No." And it came to pass, when the king heard the words of the woman, that he rent his clothes. What does that mean, when he rent his clothes? He ripped them. But what's it signify? Sorrow, grief, mourning. Do you think he was mourning the kids? Okay, well, he's showing sympathy towards it. He's rending his clothes, sympathizing with their grief, sympathizing with their problem. But what is he renting the clothes for? That's the next question. So, is it because the women had to do that? Is it because of the children? Is it because of the famine? Is it because of his poor decisions? What is he renting his clothes for? Because that sets the stage for the whole issue. When you and I, at times in our life, when we blame God and we try to separate God from our problems because of doubting Him instead of relying on Him, we do the same thing in a roundabout way as what this man's about to do. So he rents his clothes in verse 30. And the next phrase, and he passed by upon the wall, and the people looked, and behold, he had sackcloth within and upon his flesh. And here is his response. Then he said, "God do so, and more also to me, if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, shall stand on him this day." What's he doing? He's blaming Elijah for the famine. He's blaming everything on the prophet of God. And all he's doing, who put him in this mess? He did. He's the one with the bad choices. He's the one who did all the things that God would not have wanted him to do, doing the rituals and doing the sacrifices and worshiping other gods and all the things that all of those bad kings did. That was the one thing they were noted for. The king was to turn the heart of Israel back to God. And whenever the kings started doing anything different, then God can no longer bless the nation of Israel. God can no longer allow things to do and go a direction he wanted it to go. So put that in our life. When we begin to look at situations of life that we may have even brought on or we may have even caused, we may not have had nothing to do with it, but we just live in this broken world. And we're nailed with these things. And then all of a sudden we blame God for them. And what we do is we cut ourselves off of God. And then we blame God. And then anybody who tries to encourage us, anybody who tries to talk to us and say, you know, hey, just trust in God. I don't want nothing to do with God. Or, I'm not going to church. I'm not talking to the preacher. I don't want nothing to do with the Bible. And all those things, you begin to blame something else instead of really finding out who the true blame or where the true blame needs to go. So we find him doing this in verse 31. He is blaming Elisha, and he's looking at that and simply saying that God's going to do to him, which is what? God do so and more also to me. What do you think that means? What did we just read about? God, let me be the one they feast on. God, let me be the one. If Elijah's head is not here by the end of the day. They were going after Elisha, and they were going to take him, and it's all his fault. And so when we look at this and we understand this, God is the one, again, God is the one that blesses us. God is the one that protects us, even when we don't deserve it. Even when we don't think God should, and we probably shouldn't, because basically, verse 27, go back up to that one, if the Lord do not do so, if God wanted help you, again, what do you want me to do? And he gives the son to eat. I mean, they took it upon themselves. They didn't look and see what God would want them. They didn't understand what God was expecting of them. So he goes in verse 32. There's that great word in the beginning verse of 32. But, you know what that tells me? God's got a different plan. How many times in our life do we need this pause on that word for a minute? Because all that we see, all that we think, all that we understand, all that we feel, and all the craziness in our life, but we're children of God. But God is the one that's going to help us. God is the one that's going to take care of us. Elisha sat in his house, and the elders sat with him. The king sent a man for before him, but ere the message came to him, and he said to the elders, see ye how this son of a murderer have sent to take away my head. Who is he talking about? He was the head, but who was the murderer? The king. Elisha said, the king is the one who murdered all these people. The king is the one who caused the siege. The king is the one who is allowing this cannibalism and allowing everything else to go on. It's the king's fault. Yet he sends for my head. And so Elisha knew, obviously, he knew what was going on. And under normal conditions, listen, these things don't happen. Normal conditions, I wouldn't eat a donkey's brain if it was free, let alone pay for it. There are things that are going on that is not normal. There are things that are going on in our world today that we look at and say, this isn't normal. This isn't right. This is so wrong. And who do we blame? We blame the guy in the White House. We blame. Who is to blame? Who has a part in any of it? I think our world goes the way it goes because God's children don't go the right way. All of this happened because the king was disobeying God. And therefore, as the leadership goes, so does all the people under him. And so for him to say that he was sending and blaming Elisha was interesting because the murderers come to look for his head. And then he told the messenger in verse 32, when the messenger cometh, shut the door, hold him fast at the door. is not the sound of his master's feet behind him. In other words, don't let him in because the king's coming right behind him. And he's saying, don't do that. Don't let him in. Because as the details are shown in this, and again, verse 33, while yet they talked, behold, the messenger came, and he said, behold, the evil is of the Lord. What should I wait for the Lord any longer? Or why should I wait for the Lord any longer? All that was going on and all that the king created was a huge question in all the people's mind about God. You see, when he blamed God, and it's the same in our life. When we begin to blame God for the struggles of our life, the world around us look at us and say, well, then why would I want God? Why would I wait on God to do anything? Because the people are representing him this well, or this way. And so some of the details basically tell us they valued basically worthless things. They valued those things. That's what led them into the position they were at. And again, as we look at a personal application to all of this, basically above the needs, your needs above others. You know, it's, again, we talked this morning about everybody in Acts chapter 2 having things, laying at the apostles' feet, so everybody had things. And it's that self-care, but yet at the same time, caring for others as you would care for yourself. And again, also placing the blame on everything and everyone except where it goes. And we call that justifying. We call that excuses. We call that all kind of things. And so, you know, although this is quite graphic, and again, I can't believe that cannibalism is in the Bible. And it's in the Bible under God's people. But at the same time, it wasn't normal. It wasn't right. And it was all because of the disobedience. So do you put that into our world? Put that into our thinking. What can we pull from this of the world in which we live? If all of this was going on because of the king's disobedience and then the people's disobedience and they were just doing everything they could to survive, what's that look like in our world? How can we apply that to our world? Is everything going on in our world correct? I mean, and it's only going to get worse. So where's the blame lie? Yeah. And there's a lot of truth in coming into that. As the leadership goes, so does go everybody. And that was probably a true statement. But I think we're supposed to be involved in positions of leadership so that we can. You know, that was God's intent with the nation of Israel when he placed them at the crossroads of life. The crossroads between the two major highways that everyone had to walk. That was the promised land. And that everybody coming in and out of that land was going to be influenced by, for God, by the nation of Israel, except they disobeyed him. Sure. Sure. Yeah. It was a textbook. I mean, how many speeches and how many letters of our forefathers were written with scripture in them? That was their textbook. That's what they studied with when they went to school. A lot of them school in the younger ages at homes and different things. Yeah, but Yeah, and there was Kim was sharing that we, you know, from that we took all the kids away from that arena and started Christian schools and homeschools and all those things. And those are great. Those are great things. I'm not cutting any of that down, but we have taken our influence out of that arena. And again, look what we have now. I mean, it's totally different. Christian schools today, Harvard, Yale, all those big 10 schools were started that direction. But now look at them. They're nowhere near any of that teaching and any of that stuff. And so who's to blame that our world is like it is? Now, I agree, some of the decisions being made are not the right decisions. But we have to take some responsibility in all that too. Man. Real quick little history thing. Abraham Lincoln, he lost a son while he was in the White House, and when he was president, and he lost a son before he was in presidency. And there was a tomb by the White House or his office where he was that his son was put in, and every day he would go to his son and he would open up that tomb and he would sit there. While he was still president, Civil War, everything going on crazy, and he would sit there and he would mourn his son. And he did it for days, months. Open it up. I can't even fathom that. Open it up. Because he wanted to be close to his son. A pastor wanted to have a sit with him, so he got permission, got all the clearances, got in there, and he sat with him, and he convinced him and told him, why are you mourning the dead when your son is not there? And Abraham Lincoln knew the Bible well. He quoted it all the time. He knew it well. And he said, your son is not here, your son is alive. And from that day on, he no longer went to the tomb. But 2 days after that meeting with that pastor actually, it is stated that the pastor led him to the Lord. Closer to the Lord. They say he had a relationship before that, but and that day he surrendered it all to God. And 2 days later he was on a train headed to Gettysburg. And with that thought in his mind about his son and the freedom and the Bible, he wrote the Gettysburg Address. You see, when you do it God's way, God does some amazing things. And it was just a letter he wrote on the train because he needed to address them. And that letter has gone down in history as an unbelievable speech because he was cleared and freed from his grief and his mourn because a pastor was willing to confront. See, the leader, when we get involved and we share the truth, things change. Things happen. This king did not do that. This king blamed God instead of going to God and giving the truth. And to me, the lesson of this is we've got to understand that. We can't go blaming God. We can't go blaming other things. We can't go blaming other people. You know, we can't blame others for things going on around us when we're not willing to stand up and give the truth and be the truth and make the difference. Because all it is a passing game. All it is a blame shift. Just like Abraham did. Just like Isaac, just like all of them at times in their life. Every one of them we can see where they would take and they would give the responsibility to someone else. And then even Adam in the Garden of Eden did the same thing right off the get-go. They all blamed. They all shift. And I'm venturous to say that you and I will do the same thing and have done the same thing. When we begin to blame everything around us, what is my part in this? You know, what is my... If the king would, when he rent his clothes, he rent them because he wanted nothing to do with God. He didn't rent his clothes because the women killed their son and now they're mad because the one reneged. He rented his clothes because it's God's fault. God's big enough not to let this happen. God's great enough not to let this happen. He blamed God as he was living out of the will of God. And Elisha says, no, the murderer has come to get me. The one who caused all this is coming to get me. Now hold the door. We ain't going nowhere. And I love the stand that Elisha took. And nope, ain't going to happen. So it's an unbelievable lesson. It's an unbelievable part of Scripture. And, you know, reading through and studying through, and I'm like, well, we got to open this up on a Sunday night. This is interesting. Because it's not your normal study about all that they were doing. And there anything to add to that? Anything? Yeah, they're trying to make a different way of a hamburger without the hamburger. They're doing unbelievable things because if they're blaming the global warming. They're blaming all the chaos. If you just look over the past 2 years of the blame shift of the virus, of the vaccination, of the closings, of the police riots, unbelievable. And it's the same. We may not have been in a famine to have to eat like they did, but we are in a famine of morals. We are in a famine of right and wrong. We are in a famine that God is no longer being exemplified well in the world in which we live. They're trying to take him out. But you know the greatest thing about this is God still has his remnant, doesn't he? He always will have his remnant of faithful people. And that's our job. To stay in that remnant of faithful people. But you can't blame others for some of the situations you find yourself in. Because the only thing you can control in life is your attitude and your actions. Nothing else is yours to control. You can't control what's going on. You can't control how it's going on. All you can control is your actions and your attitudes. Attitudes come first, then the actions follow. So, if he would have controlled things differently, they may not have been in siege. They may not have been surrounded. Again, the Syrian army took Samaria, and they took it in a very ugly way. And so, there are struggles and battles in our life that the enemy, Satan, has put a wall around us, thinking we cannot have our connection with God. We cannot have God, because we doubt him, because we don't do it the way God would want it done. And man, we have all the power within us to break that siege. We have all the power within us to do it differently. So that to me is the struggle. That's also the lesson that, man, we got to do it God's way. We have to seek his will. And like we shared last week and this week, living in God's will, no matter what, is what God has asked us to do. And this is very, I think it's very obvious of a text today to be able to do that. Any other questions, comments, anything else we want to throw to that? Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I agree with that completely. Because we don't see things change, and therefore, why pray? Yeah. Yeah, prayer is a powerful thing, but praying and believing that God will be God, and that doesn't mean it's going to look like you want it to look, but God will still be God, and God will make sure and take care of. He's promised to take care of us, and I really pray that he doesn't take care of me by feeding me donkey brains. There's got to be a better way. I'll eat fish. I'll eat grass before I eat down. But you know, he's promised to take care of us, hasn't he? And we have to trust that, because when we don't trust it, we go on our own. We try on our own, or we just give up. And we can't give up. We give up, we're done. We're surrounded and we're done. Anything else? Any other? I trust you all go have a snack tonight now. Yeah, that's true. I've also eyeballs and fishbowl eyeballs and all things that, yeah, we have not been that desperate yet. And I pray to God we never are, but. And the problem is they pay a lot of money for those too. Yes. There's a lot of delicacies. And that's one of the things that you missionaries probably, in, especially like the islands that are up in Papua New Guinea in the bush, you eat what they eat. And if you don't, you offend them. For all you guys who like to watch hunting shows, you need to watch The Meat Eater. If you've never seen that show, I've seen him eat some things that they no way. He actually says the meat behind the eyeball tastes like bread. Okay, I'll take your word for it. There's a lot of different things out there. But you know, I think the important thing that we see tonight is that we are living in a world that has shunned responsibility, has passed responsibility, and I think for the reason of no accountability. Because if I'm not responsible, I'm not accountable. Little do they know that the righteous judge is lying in wait, as 1 Peter 4:5 says, that righteous judge is lying in wait, waiting to judge. And we got to take responsibility. We got to be able to take that responsibility of what our deal is, what we do right, what we do wrong, and trust God to pick up the pieces when it's all said and done. So that's my thesis of the day. Could have said that and been out of here in 10 minutes, but why do that? You got a lesson from the scriptures. Now, if anybody asks you about cannibalism, you can say, yeah, it's in the Bible. Go for it. Oh, man. Jim, you walked in at a bad time, brother. Oh, my. I appreciate the study. And again, I like to get into different places, different ideas, different studies, and pick it apart. That's what we do when we dig in. But there's always application. There's always principles that we can pull of it. And I really think not blaming, taking responsibilities, because we're going to be accountable anyway. Take the responsibility. And to go with the responsibility. If you got to make things right, make things right. If you got to change life, change life. Do what God would ask you to do, instead of blaming everybody else for the mess that may be around us, or maybe even the mess you get in. It's not anybody's fault. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the study tonight, and Lord, it is different, but yet we